I'm gonna knock this off. Okay. Gosh, I don't know. I'm so nervous. Pull it together. Okay. Thank you. Okay, I've shared my story so many times in the city that I was initially reluctant to accept when Lynn asked me to share my story once again. What more could I possibly add?
We've enjoyed you each time.
Thank you. Thanks. Okay, but sometimes hearing something twice or even three times reinforces a message, and so I'm hopeful that if this is your second or third or fourth or fifth or I don't know how many years I've been doing this for, that hearing my story will, you'll be able to glean something new from tonight's message. The Gemara in Shabbos discusses how an individual who loves blood, and the recommendation that the Gemara gives to this person is that they should become a shochet or a mohel. That if their inclination is to love blood, which is obviously a very bizarre thing, perhaps they might be inclined to want to murder. And the Gemara suggests that rather this person should become an animal slaughterer or a mohel, someone who performs bris milah. And the idea behind this is that Hashem can give an individual a desire, but that the human spirit has the ability to spin that desire on its head and use it for good. Whew. So it's with that in mind that I share with you my story. I'd like to give you some insight into what it's like to be obese. Imagine not being able to shop at your regular clothing store. Imagine having to order, special order online, boots that have extensions for your extra, extra, extra large calves. Imagine having to ask the stewardess on your airplane for an extension for your seatbelt. Imagine... Are there dishes anywhere? Thank you. Imagine going to sleep every night and waking and davening that you'll wake up half the size that you are. Imagine every time going to the store, the clothing store, and buying a size larger than the time before. Imagine people constantly asking you if you're pregnant. Or family members making cute little, "Oh, I just tried this new diet. You should hear about it. It's really amazing." Cute little drops of like, "Hey, you should really lose weight." Sorry. Imagine preparing 3 pizza bagels for your kids' lunches and eating all of them before they ever get into your kid's backpack. Aside from the physical ailments of gnawing back pain, I promised that I would not do this. I'm so sorry. Okay. The challenges associated with obesity are both emotional and psychological as well. To stand in a room and wonder if you're the biggest person in that room. The feelings of failure. Of constantly stopping to believe in yourself and your purpose. These are just a few examples of what life as an obese person looks like. I don't know what happened. I don't know how it happened. I think of it as a miracle. But on April 23rd, 2010, a switch went on, and thank God it hasn't gone off. I committed myself to a very strict food plan and exercise on a daily basis. It took me a year and a half to lose 135 pounds. I was about 275 when I started. And I joined a gym, Lifetime, and I started exercising. Shortly thereafter, I was encouraged by my fitness instructor to become a certified fitness instructor. And I was able to take all the pain that I was in and use it to help other people. Okay. In the last 6 years, I've built a business servicing people with fitness classes, food support, accountability, and emotional support when it comes to eating. Every day I meet with people who were just like me. I get to hear their struggle and give them hope that if I could do it, most certainly they can as well. Thank you. That's so much better. In the past 6 years, since my weight loss, I've met so many people. I'm going to leave these for you guys. I've met so many people who aren't even obese, but have so much self-hatred, low self-esteem, and painfully horrible self-body image. While it's something that I still struggle with, I would like to offer three helpful tools for overcoming feelings of insecurity, because they don't only plague people who are obese, they plague all of us. I must look like a basket case up here. It's a lot of tissues. Thank you. As Orthodox women with big families, we often put ourselves last. We set unrealistic expectations on ourselves and standards that for most people are too hard to live up to. So here are the three things I'd like you to walk away with tonight. The first is changing how you talk to yourself. I used to wake up every morning and say, my parents are obese, so I'm going to be obese. Instead now, I try to remind myself to take care of myself. And that I'm worth it. I once heard a beautiful idea that we wake up in the morning and we say, Moda Ani. It's the first thing that we say. It sets the tone for the whole day. We say, Moda Ani. I gratefully, I thank. Moda Ani Fanecha, Melechai V'Kayam, the king of, you know, who's everlasting. Shechazarta B'Nishmasi, who restored my soul to me, B'Chemla, with compassion. Rabba Emunasecha, and I used to think, or most people sometimes think, that Rabba Emunasecha means that I have so much faith in Hashem. But really, Rabba Emunasecha means that Hashem has so much faith in me. So the first thing I'd like you to leave with tonight is change how you talk to yourself. So often we look at ourselves in the mirror and we think, oh, this could use some work and that could use some work. I have so many clients who say, I need work here, and I need work here, and my stretch mark's there. Change how you talk to yourself. Remind yourself that you're worth it, and that Hashem believes in you. The second suggestion I'd like to make is that we change how we talk to each other. Complimenting your friend and telling them that they look so skinny isn't really a compliment. The externals are not a measure for how a person behaves. I remember after I had lost about 50 pounds, someone said to me, your eyes look so clear. It was true, a cloud of darkness had definitely been lifted off of me, but it was a real and true observation. Try eliminating physicality from your conversations. Don't size people up just on how they look. Some people look so happy on the outside and are really suffering on the inside. And for some people, like me, the suffering showed on the outside. And the third thing I'd like to leave you with, which I think is so, so important, is that we change how we have our conversations with our children. Statistics show that 9 out of 10 women are dissatisfied with their bodies. Like I said before, they constantly comment on how they wish I could be 10 pounds lighter, how they wish I could be a size this or a size that, or, you know, my fill-in-the-blank body part needs work. If you feel like this about yourself, chances are that you will transmit these feelings onto your children. Tell your daughter how beautiful her smile is. How her midos, her characteristics, are what make her beautiful. Don't raise sons who will only date size 2 girls, and don't tell your daughters that they need to be size 2 in order to get a good shidduch. Emphasize how strong they are physically, emotionally, religiously, not how skinny they are or how cute their outfit looks on them. Okay. Having been overweight and obese, I know the pain. Ooh. But I also know the blessings that come with facing challenges head on and overcoming and rising above. I took my clutch, I took the thing that Hashem gave me that was a great challenge, and I use it every day to help other people overcome their challenge with it. I'd be lying if I told you that it gets easier. I've had 2 pregnancies since I've lost the weight. I'm a fitness instructor, so the entire city looks at my body on a daily basis. It's definitely not easy. Some days are easier than others, but I pick myself up daily. I change how I talk to myself, to others, and to my children, and I do the best I can to utilize the strengths that Hashem has given me to overcome this incredible challenge. Thank you for letting me share my story. Good night.
Good evening. I'm here tonight to talk about my personal journey into motherhood. I got married young, and I had no idea what the road ahead of me would entail. As I walked down the aisle, I was naive. I prayed that I could have the cookie-cutter lifestyle, to be a good wife, to be a good mother, all the things that automatically came with getting married. In my first year of marriage, I bought a package of pregnancy tests about once a week. I had no idea what was coming. Then all of my friends started getting pregnant, and they started having their babies. The months were going by, and it didn't happen for me. It was about a year and a half into my marriage, and I was at a regular doctor's checkup when I mentioned nonchalantly that I had been trying to get pregnant. So my doctor offered an ultrasound. She then said I had something called PCOS. When I asked what that was, she gave me like a short explanation, but she said there was still much to be learned about it, and I had some of the symptoms, but not all, and they weren't really sure, so she recommended that I see a specialist. When I walked into the infertility clinic for the first time, I was so emotional. I was actually terrified. There were so many unanswered questions rushing through my head, and I had none of the answers. I always thought everything was just going to fall into place for me, and now this was a new chapter, and I felt completely powerless. This was where my journey began. There were weeks and then months of trials, different medicines, different tests, techniques, thousands of dollars in the garbage, all with the same result, a negative pregnancy test. The worst part was the doctors had no answers. They kept saying, "You're young, you're healthy, you'll be pregnant next month." this shouldn't be. About a year later, they concluded that it wasn't so simple and that my body did not ovulate and probably never had. They told me that my chances of conceiving naturally were basically none. I remember that feeling of hopelessness and being so overwhelmed. Everybody around me, it felt like, was having babies or sharing news of their pregnancies, and I truly wanted to be happy for them. But inside, the scared and sad part of me felt jealous and angry. And then I would get angry at myself for feeling that way. I expected more from myself. Why wasn't I normal? Why wasn't my body being normal? And then I resented the people who were reaching out to me. Nobody understood me. Even the people who had good intentions, my supportive husband. I just felt so alone. The doctor recommended that we do IVF, which is in vitro fertilization. They said this would be our best and only chance. I live very far from my family, and most of the people surrounding me had no idea about anything that we were going through. The clinic we were at was a 30-minute drive, and we had to go 3 to 5 times a week for 6 a.m. appointments, just for blood and ultrasound. That sometimes lasted hours. Sometimes we'd wait, sometimes we'd sit in traffic for an hour. My veins were abused from all the blood they took, and the hormonal medications only made me feel worse than I already did. I felt like I was in a bubble. Nobody understood the depths of our lives, and I felt really distant from everyone. And it just seemed like all around me, everyone was moving along, and we were stuck and being held back from a normal life and the way it should be. And I didn't know how to change it. That was when I realized that it was time to let go and to let God. Infertility made me feel so powerless, and even though we were doing everything that we needed to, I had no control. I had nothing to do except surrender. I realized that Hashem wanted me exactly where I was, and that instead of beating myself up for something that I had no control over, I needed to turn to Him for help. I couldn't help but think of our Himahos, Sarah, Rivka, and Rachel. They all struggled with the same thing as me. And really, all Hashem wanted from them was the tefillah and for them to be aware that really the power came from Him. I really changed my whole perspective after that. My husband and I started viewing the process that we were in as a gift. The IVF that we were starting was a present. In the olden days, a girl that had my situation, a girl like me, had no chance of having a baby. There was nothing to do. But for me now, with our generation's medicine and science and technology, there was a real option in front of me. Now, each shot that I pierced into my body and each pill that I took gave me hope. I redefined normal. The way that it would happen, it didn't matter anymore because the goal was now the focus. It was then that I welcomed gratitude into my life. And it repaid me by replacing all that anxiety and fear that I had learned to live with. It helped me break all the barriers that I had built myself. And I started opening up to people and being vulnerable. And everybody welcomed me with support and love. I also learned that I wasn't alone. Everybody seemed to know someone who had been in my shoes. That was very relieving to me. Every day that I injected myself with shots and with medicine, I remember feeling like my body was full of black and blue marks, and it was. I was swollen, physically beaten, but I also remember the gratitude pushing me through, feeling like there was so much hope. When we finally arrived at our egg retrieval, they got a total of 46 eggs. We left the clinic that day feeling so hopeful. The doctors were so hopeful. They said, wow, that's an amazing number. I'll never forget the day we came in for our transfer. It had been 5 days since the retrieval, and we hadn't heard anything from the doctors. When my doctor walked into the room, I knew something was wrong. Her face was white, and she said, I'm so sorry. There's only one embryo. I can't believe it. None of the other ones survived. She kept saying, I'm so sorry, we didn't expect this, but there was nothing we could do. She left the room, and I remember turning to my husband, and at the same time, we both said, well, we really only need one. And that embryo is my beautiful baby gift, Josh. I went through this process twice, and I became more comfortable discussing it openly the second time. People started reaching out to me, and I truly saw how much pain there is. Girls in my situation were feeling so alone. I realized how much there is an insensitivity towards infertility, and we must show more support and do more to lift the stigma and spread awareness about how common and truly lonely this process is. Once you realize that everything is in Hashem's hand and that you have no control, anything and everything difficult really becomes beautiful. Now, every day when I wake up and I see my beautiful children, I thank Hashem for giving me this journey so that I can truly appreciate what gifts that they are. As some of you can see, I am now expecting my third. And it was quite the surprise to learn of it, being that there were no shots or pills, and the balance in the bank hadn't changed much. When I asked the doctors how, they really had no answers. But I know the answer. When you give the power back to Hashem, anything is possible. Thank you.
Well, I'll try and start here. I have to first say how honored, and blown away I am to be sitting next to both of you, and also to be in this room. And I remember when Lynn Louder. Oh, that's like my full volume. Okay, maybe I just need to stand on a chair. So when Lynn asked me to speak, she called me and I was in this cafe, and before she got the words out, I kind of knew what she was going to ask me, and I was thinking, no, please don't. And then she's like, will you speak about overcoming obstacles? And my next thought was, which one? It's like, okay, I probably qualified to speak on, a whole slew of them. And they started going through my head. And then it was sort of like the elephant in the room. And now I'm like, I don't believe I'm going to talk about this because I've never really talked about it. So I feel honored that this is a group that will receive this from me. So I will start. And the topic, the topics is abuse. So, all right. So how does someone such as myself get into such a pickle? I was a straight honor student. I was very good, borderlining on boring. And my parents worked hard to give me the best. I graduated college and I lived a nice life. I moved to New York. I studied dance. I would write poetry in cafes, and somewhere during that time, I encountered a group of Israelis. And I didn't come from a religious background, so I was reformed, but I remember sitting with these Israelis and just being enamored by, everything about them, by the way they made coffee, by the way they would ask everybody if they wanted a cup of coffee, and I was just smitten by their warmth and their sense of identity, which I think I was kind of lacking at that time. So then enter a nice-looking Yemenite Israeli man. He was from a religious home, and he was a traveler, and he was also older than me and looking to get married. And I thought, okay, this is my shortcut. I will learn Hebrew, I'll learn about being Jewish, I'll be directly tied to this seductive, exciting culture. And I placed my freedom, my soul, and the rest of my youth on the altar with reckless abandon. Had I known what was in store, and I've said this before, I would have paid for a year abroad. But I didn't. So I would be lying if I said that this relationship started out rosy, because there were red flags from the beginning. But because abuse really wasn't on my radar, and because I didn't want to think that I was actually falling in love and had already given so much of my freedom over to a man that might actually be abusive, I would tell myself, no, you're just being sensitive, you're in your imagination, there's no way. I mean, I was actually a women's studies major at University of Wisconsin, and one of my final papers were on battered women. So there was no way, but there was. So at first, it was subtle. He would cook these delicious Yemenite dishes with these wonderful spices that I'd never tasted. He would take me shopping, and he would take care of me when I wasn't feeling well. But there were signs. And once I was pregnant, the warning signs disappeared, and I found myself falling deeper and deeper into a massive, like, spider web, kind of the best way to describe it. And then what happened over the course of the next 8 years was to be the most beautiful and memorable time of my life, as well as the most horrendous and painful. It was a magical time when all three of my babies were born. I remember picnics with them at Mother's Beach in Marina Del Rey, California. And I recall walking by the channel and any given day seeing a school of dolphins, and it was, like, amazing. I remember reading to them at night and getting lost in these picture books. It's my favorite thing to do with them. I also remember being so totally enwrapped in their beautiful, gorgeous world, receiving more love from them in one glance than I had ever known in my entire life. Yet, at the same time, I was living under the unimaginable pressure of a very abusive relationship. And I could stand here and I could tell you for the next 10, 15 minutes stories that will probably make you cry or wince or, you know, and, you know, these are textbook stories of abuse, stories of public humiliation, stories of having finances held just out of arm's reach. And I could tell you what it feels like to have the father of your babies call you names that you wouldn't even call your worst enemies. And he would call them to me in English, Hebrew, and Arabic. So it was, I mean, I'm laughing. Thank God I'm laughing at that, because I could see the humor in it. But at the time, it was awful. And I could also fill a book of all of the episodes of abuse, but that is not the book that I want to write, and that's certainly not a book I want to share. But I will share just a couple incidences that I think might give you an idea of how I got stuck in my story. So shortly after we found out I was pregnant, and I was pregnant with twins, and I was pregnant with boy twins, so it was super intense. I was 24 years old, and a lot going on in my body. And late one night, I just wanted to go to sleep. And then he said, I'll do my Israeli accent. He said, come, Barry. I want to show you something. He sat me down. He took out a pen and paper. And he started to do this mathematical equation. And I'm watching him, and it felt like an hour. I mean, it was probably literally 15, 20 minutes. And I'm doing these numbers, and I'm just like, oh, I want to go to bed. And then at the end, I see at the bottom of the paper, $1. And he pointed it to it. Oh. He pointed to it, and he said, see, Barry, this is what you're worth. So part of me thought, there was a part of me that said, he is nuts. But unfortunately, by this point in the relationship, the more of me believed him than not. And I wasn't like an honors student, but I don't know. It's a process. I still cannot quite wrap my head around. So it was really a lose-lose every time, because here was the man I had chosen to marry, and here was a man telling me I was worth no more than a dollar. So my options usually were that he might be right, and I could be better. I could try harder, and I could mold myself into whatever it was that would change as soon as I mastered it, he'd find a new task. Or I was a nutball for choosing to marry such a person. So I was in a story. I didn't see a way out. I'll tell you one more story. Okay. So I had preemie twins that were born very little, and I had no family where I lived. So I would be nursing them, and preemie twins need to eat every 2 hours. So you have two babies needing to nurse every 2 hours, and you're on your own. So that is, there's really no sleep in that. And he would go down to the couch and sleep, and I was on my own pretty much. And I remember waking up, and I'd be like, I don't think I woke up, but I'd like go downstairs when the light came out, and he would look at me, and he'd say, "I want coffee." And I would be like, something in me wanted to scream obscenities toward him, but another part of me wanted to prove that I'm a good wife. I got this. I could be Superwoman, and I would make him coffee, and then he would leave for work, and I'd find the cup of coffee sitting there untouched. So, needless to say, I would spend hours fantasizing about how to poison his coffee, and I really did. And I came up with some crazy ways, but I never did it. But again, here's an example of me. I was in a story. Okay. I was in a story, and I had given up way too much penmanship to him in exchange for what I thought may be security or love or acceptance or worth. Did I cry? Yes. Did I threaten to leave? Yes. But he would turn around with a gift or words of endearment, and I would fall back every time. I just didn't see any hope outside of him. The mountains in the distance that I would have to climb alone looked impossible. And I wish I could have set my eyes on the horizon and just take one step in front of the other. And I did. Often I did. But there was a lot of falling down. There were so many obstacles. And I'm looking and I'm noticing faces who've seen me on this journey. And it's reminding me of where I was. But these obstacles, being 20-something at the time, having three babies, one who needed special services. I had no financial security, and at every moment I felt like this fire-breathing dragon right on my neck, who had all the time in the world to scheme and plot, and was always a few steps ahead of me, and how to, trap me or stop me. And here I was just living by the moment, trying to take care of my babies. Ultimately, though, I did leave. So the moment I left was when I saw my little 3-year-old boy turn to his brother and speak to him the same way his father spoke to me. And I wish I could say that I left because of one of the 1,000 times he spoke to me abusively, but it wasn't. And I also wish I could say that that was the moment when my life became peaceful and easier and it was all behind me, but it didn't. So I left LA against court orders to remain there. I was served papers there. He knew that if he served me papers, I'd have to stay there. But I left. Anyway, about 4 years of keeping a low profile here, because at any moment he could have turned me in for kidnapping. And as I say this, I'm like, wow, this is a story. Okay. I casually told a woman who was one of my dearest friends that I didn't have my get. And I'm very low profile. And I didn't tell anybody, and I just kind of living day by day. And she literally grabbed me by the hand and brought me to Rabbi Gelman. So she encouraged me, along with many people in the community, to pursue it. When I brought it, and I'm another thing I have to say is that I'm looking around too, and I know there's people. So Rabbi Gelman was the first person I spoke with, and then the Hillel Torah community, your shul helped put a fund aside, so just lots of people were behind me and supporting me and encouraging me to keep going. So when I brought it up to my children's father, call him, I said, "I want my get." And he said to me, "You will be in your grave before I give you a get," in his thick Israeli accent. And that was exactly what he said. I will never forget those words. But with the support of friends and community, I persisted. The days and days spent speaking with organizations and rabbis and friends, plotting and scheming how we would trick him, how we would force him. The days of my life spent on this task, it made no sense. But finally, It made no sense. And it, just for anybody who knows somebody going through this, I have no words for this experience. It's something that I've talked to rabbis from Jerusalem. I talked to people at, I think it's Ora. I mean, Shalva, rabbis in Los Angeles, every rabbi. And it was, there wasn't one who was like, oh, sure, of course, you know. Everyone, it was just something that some people were uncomfortable dealing with it. And it's just something I still don't understand, that this physicality piece of it. So what did I do? So about a year and a half into it, on the fast of Esther, I didn't plan this, but I got in my car and I drove straight to Rabbi Schwartz. I never met him, didn't know anything. I just was very inspired to go to him. I ended up sitting with him for over an hour. And I have to say that was another experience that I am blessed, I guess, to have had that hour with him. But at the end, he told me there was nothing he could do. And he pointed to a drawer right next to him at his desk, and he told me this drawer is okay. He told me this drawer is full of letters written to me from Agunot, whose husbands have beaten them. And then we said goodbye. So needless to say, and I hope all those women got a gut. So needless to say, 1 month later, I got my gut. So there it is. And the get came about through the efforts of the community funding this incredible lawyer in Los Angeles. And there were two rabbis out there. And it's in everybody else along the way. And I do believe the conversation with Rabbi Schwartz. And I think spiritually something opened up for me. Okay, so here I am. I have left abusive man. I have my guts. Everything is wonderful, right? So it isn't. So the spiritual and emotional struggle and the work of letting go of such a deep story and stepping into the light of my soul and reclaiming its innate divinity and unscathed beauty had just begun. And this ended up being much more challenging than I could ever have dreamed of. And it also is the reason why when Lynn asked me, I was like, wait, I haven't overcome my obstacle. Because I think, like Sipporah said, it's every day I'm overcoming this piece of it, this piece of believing that my soul is equally, divine and beautiful as it was when I entered the world. Okay, is there a way out from our obstacles and from our stories? So this chapter behind, now it's like, how do I live my life now with having so much of a pull, having this man who's still the father of my kids showing up, so constant reminders. And I remember, so my practice is yoga. I'm a yoga teacher, and that's also kind of my way of being able to get through this. So before I became a yoga teacher, I had this dream of an elephant. I had this dream that I'm like, might be my phone. Okay, so is it there? It's okay. So it's so funny. This is like a yoga moment because it happens in yoga class, and like it happens so much. I'm just like, it's just life. Anyway, so I had this dream of an elephant, and I remembered it so vividly. It was this caged elephant. Like, I was in this room, and it was caged, and I was, like, terrified, and this elephant had so much anger and terror. It was like, I was like, oh, my gosh, get me out of this space. And then I decided to go through a yoga teacher training. I became a yoga teacher, and then shortly thereafter, I remember having this dream of an elephant, but the elephant was free, and I was right next to it. And I remember in this dream, the feeling of its like trunk. It was like very vivid. So that's just to kind of set up kind of what yoga does for me. Okay. So as a yoga teacher, I intentionally put my students into postures where they will struggle. So this is kind of, I guess, how I'm using my story to help other people and to help myself. I take them through this process, the process of allowing yourself to be in struggle. of keeping a curious mind, of having no expectations of this moment, of allowing your thoughts while at the same time focusing on your breath. And it's usually at that moment when you want to either fight or flight, but you don't. And that is when the breakthrough happens. It is at that moment where if you are present and breathing and curious, that you just might find space. That you just may notice that the pain and the thoughts and the story are not your soul. These are the thorns that remind us that we are so much bigger than any story, than any pain, than any experience that dares to define us. So, Shavua is around the corner, and I was thinking that when Hashem came to the Israelites in the desert, right? He came to them in the desert. He came to them in their struggle for identity, right? He could have come to them when they already succeeded, when they overcame and perfected themselves, but that's not when Hashem came the closest to us that we've ever known in our history. He came to us when there were still remnants of slavery, still constantly tugging at us. And God did not invite us to go up on the mountain. Instead, he brought it down to us through Moses. God met us where we were in our struggle. So I thought that was an interesting connection. And that's kind of, thank God that he doesn't wait for us to make it. He meets us there because I don't know. I wouldn't make it. All right. So just a couple more thoughts. Actually, I'm not going to say this. I'm going to talk about the most inspiring person to me. And I'll just start here. So, what does it take to dive in? To forget who we thought we were and allow ourselves to be who we truly are. There's a quote that says, "You must lose sight of the shore to get to the other side." Okay, so the most inspiring person to me, the person who at any given moment, just the thought of him, there's this voice in my head that says, "Barry, you could reach higher, you could be better." So it's my son, Noam. And Noam is a person. Noam was born. An emergency C-section, and he didn't have any signs of life till 10 minutes. And the reason they took him out was because there was no heartbeat before. So he is okay. So here he comes into the world, and then immediately has a seizure, and immediately, has many things going on. And I remember, I'll share this with you, he had no blood, his platelets were gone. His body just took such a blow. And he had to be in isolation. And I remember, and this is one good thing I could say about his father came in, and Noam's eyes were closed. There was no movement, nothing. And his father started reading Tehillim. And I swear to you, I saw Noam's eyes open up, and it was something, I feel like I need to share it, because I didn't come from this background, but I saw it with my own eyes, just how a soul responds to that. So that's Noam, that's his soul. His soul is that pure and beautiful. Anyway, so just a couple of things about Noam. I remember meeting with the neurologist. This was Cedars-Sinai Hospital in L.A. So you have the top teams of doctors, and the neurologist said, kids don't walk out of this. And I said, "What do you mean?" It's like, you're probably not going to walk. And I'm like, "Well, is he going to live?" And they're like, "I don't know." So, but the words were, you don't recover from this, this kind of a thing, seizures and having no sign of life. And then sure enough, 1 year after, we had to have a follow-up. And he kicked us out of the office because he said we don't need to see him. He's okay, and he was so happy. And Noam has continued to do this. He was just on the Hillel Torah basketball team. He doesn't go to Hillel Torah. And Maura Cheryl is here. She's the coach. He goes to Bessie Rhodes, a public school. We tried to keep him in day school. But he went out for the basketball team, and they let him be on the varsity basketball team. Okay, so Noah made 11 points on varsity basketball, and he made a three-pointer. And it's just mind-blowing, if you know Noam, because it's just like he can't, like, to dribble, stop, and shoot doesn't happen. So what they would do is they would set him up, and Noam has a twin brother. And his twin brother would pass him the ball. And this other boy would block, and then Noam would shoot, and he would make it in, and everybody would be on their feet, and even the other team would cheer. So I was going to tell a totally different story, but I think this is it. This is about Noam, and this is about somebody who does not live in their story. This is about somebody, I mean, one more thing about him. After we got through the hospital, he was diagnosed with this very rare kidney disease. So I was like 24. I didn't even tell my family. I'm like, what is going on? I had this abusive husband. And I'm treating him, medicating him throughout days and nights. And I have a best friend, thank God, who is a doctor, and she got us into the Mayo Clinic. And so he was diagnosed with this rare kidney disease that was supposed to, you know, end his life by 21 and whatever. And then we went there to the Mayo Clinic. We met with the top doctor, and she looked at me and him, and she said, 99%, he doesn't have it. So I just, you know, these stories about Noam, it's just, this is who he is. He is somebody who does not live in his story, and he shows me how to, you know, not let anything really, really define you. So this one short, I'm almost at the end, this one short part about something he gave me. So they did have a trip with their father to Israel this past holiday, or not Pesach, the Rosh Hashanah. And then I've never been to Israel. And I asked them, it was my dream, I said, you know, I wanted to send them a letter to put in the kotel. And I forgot, because I was so nervous about my kids traveling with, you know who. Okay. So I forgot. And then I get this FaceTime call, and all three of them, it's Dawn, and they're starting to drive to Yerushalayim from Nahariya. And I'm like, oh, hey, guys. And Noam's like, Mom, we're going to the kotel. What do you want to, where's the note? What do you want us to write? So the thing about Noam is that his diagnosis, his story is a diagnosis of apraxia. I mean, his memory, it's like you never know. He, you know, 4 times 4, he's going into high school. It's not happening. It's not happening. He asks Siri, what's 4 times 4? You know, he does his homework with his phone. But he remembered that I wanted that. And then, I mean, it would have gone unnoticed. And then I said, okay, I'll text it to you. So I texted his twin brother. I said, no, I helped your brother. And then I sent Noam a text, and I said to him, hi, please write for me. I pray for inner and outer peace for all. I pray that my family have great health and happiness and all good things. I pray that my children have a good, clear path and are always looked after with love and care. And I pray that I marry my Besheret and bring the light from that union to my family and beyond. Very. And then I wrote, thanks, Noam. Many hours later, I get a text from Noam. Mom, I wrote it. So I just think, you know, and it's laborious for him to write. But the message of my soul's deepest wants went through him. Here is someone who answered the call without assessing ability or entertaining lack, or why, or how, or redirecting, or complaining. Mom, this is too hard. Why didn't you write it down in the first place? He showed up completely in the present moment. And at the end of the day, what gets us through, what inspires us to place one foot in front of the other when it's challenging, isn't our brains, or good looks, or social status, or any place of arrival. It is pure, genuine love, the love of a soul who forgets his or her story, his or her limitations, and steps into the fullness of their neshama. So I thank you for this invitation. I find it beautifully ironic that I'm actually 2 weeks shy of approaching my 40th birthday. And like the Israelites, I am ready to leave the years of wandering, of soul searching, of stories that I have outgrown. It's sort of like a graduation, actually, to be here. I kind of feel like I'm graduating. And I really, I do, because I have always felt a little bit outside just because of my background and just because of being a single woman all this time and all the other limitations I put on myself. But here I am. So it's like a graduation, the excitement, the anticipation is something completed. Though what is really exciting is the celebration of something new, the unfolding of a future or a path, the wide, wide world lie at my feet, and the realization that every moment is a graduation. Every moment holds the possibility for a totally new experience, a totally new way of seeing someone or something. So I am ready to step, I'm ready to step into the framework of all of my lessons learned and all of my strengths that have emerged. One step in front of the other, eyes on the horizon, and this time it is not a mountain that I see before me, but my beautiful life as it is in this moment, peopled by the loveliest of souls. And this time it is not the voice of limitation I hear. It is the silence of freedom. And will there be obstacles? Sure. But my work is to inspire, which means to breathe, to let the energy pass through me. Life flows through me. It creates through these hands and face and lips and feet and hips and eyes. The energy doesn't have to storm me. I can choose to let it pass, to keep open and let it pass through me and change me for the good. And I could watch quietly this beautiful transformation. And when the voice of limitation sneaks in with her little ruler, I will gently rest in my heart, pen in my hand, and take one more step. Thank you.
There's nothing I can say except for thank you for sharing your strength and your inspiration and your story. And for showing us how you've each been able to step out of that story. Thank you so much. Have a good night.